For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the show all about audiobooks recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, we're checking out some of the titles shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize. Bernardine Evaristo reflects on the lives of 12 black British women in her vibrant novel, Girl, Woman, Other.
What I wanted to do with the novel was to explore a wider expanse of black British womanhood than we would normally encounter in fiction.
Lucy Ellman takes us into the strange world of her 8-sentence novel, Ducks Newburyport.
It's all very new to me. It never occurred to me that this would happen, and I'm sort of watching to see what it is. I don't really know what it is yet.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Girl, Woman, Other follows the lives and struggles of 12 very different characters. Mostly women, black and British, they tell the stories of their families, friends and lovers across the country and through the years. It's a vibrant reflection on what it is to be a black woman in contemporary Britain that pulls no punches but is also full of humour, tenderness and optimism. Thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation, Girl, Woman, Other, like all the books shortlisted for the prize, is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB24908, which is narrated by Anna Maria Nabiri.
Amma is walking along the promenade of the waterway that bisects her city. A few early morning barges cruise slowly by. To her left is the nautical-themed footbridge with its deck-like walkway and sailing mast pylons. To her right is the bend in the river as it heads east past Waterloo Bridge towards the Dome of St. Paul's. She feels the sun begin to rise, the air still breezy before the city clogs up with heat and fumes. A violinist plays something suitably uplifting further along the promenade. Amma's play, The Last Amazon of Dahomey, opens at the National tonight. She thinks back to when she started out in theatre, when she and her running mate Dominique developed a reputation for heckling shows that offended their political sensibilities. Their powerfully trained actor voices projected from the back of the stalls before they made a quick getaway. They believed in protest that was public, disruptive, and downright annoying to those at the other end of it. She remembers pouring a pint of beer over the head of a director whose play featured semi-naked black women running around on stage behaving like idiots before doing a runner into the back streets of Hammersmith howling.
Anna Maria Nabiri narrating Girl, Woman, Other, written by Bernardine Evaristo, who joined me down the line from Brunel University to tell me more. Bernardine Evaristo, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me on the programme.
And many congratulations on being shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize.
Thank you for that as well. I'm delighted.
Now, the book is in the RNIB Talking Books library, and I've been thoroughly enjoying it over the weekend. For those who haven't yet picked it up, could you just introduce us to it?
Yes, well, it's called Girl, Woman, Other, and it's about 12 primarily black British women. And they are aged 19 to 93, and they come from different cultural backgrounds. They are of different classes and sexualities. They have different occupations. They are of different generations, obviously, because they're aged 19 to 93. And what I wanted to do with the novel was to explore a wider expanse of black British womanhood than we would normally encounter in fiction. So I call the novel a fusion fiction, in the sense that each woman has her own section, but all the stories in some way or other are fused with each other's stories. So I have 4 mothers and daughters in the novel, and I have women who are also friends of some of the leading characters and also colleagues. And the overall effect is this interlinked network of women who in some way are related to or shaped by or inform each other. And it was 5 years in the writing, and I called it Girl, Woman, Other, because apart from one character who's no longer living, with each woman, we meet her in the novel at the age she is when the novel opens, which is in contemporary society today. But we also go back into their past and childhoods to a greater or lesser extent. So we see the women as women, we see them as girls. And the reason I called it other is because often women are othered in society. Black women are definitely othered in society. But the women are also othered maybe because of their class or because of their sexuality or because of the country that they might have come from. And the women also other each other in the sense that they're not all necessarily going to approve of each other. So there are a couple of characters who you might consider to be homophobic, and then there are characters who are on the homosexual spectrum. So it's a novel full of lots of different things going on.
Whilst the women come from very differing backgrounds, differing heritages, actually a lot of their experience is shared experience. Sexism, harassment, overbearing fathers or brother figures, which is what pulls them together. You realise that when they're talking amongst themselves, they have got these frustrations to their hopes and their loves and their lives.
Interesting perspective in terms of that being something that binds them together. I would say that the book is about their ambition and about their desires, but it's also about the obstacles they face. That's not to say that the book is about their lives being only struggle, because it's also a celebration of their lives. And it's a celebration of them and all their diversity and complexity, and with all their flaws and so on. But as a writer of fiction, one has to think about what are the problems your characters are going to encounter, because that is the meat of fiction. You can't just give your characters happy lives. So that's always embedded in there. And because they are women, to varying degrees, they do experience sexism. Not all of them would even think to call themselves feminist, although some of them are decidedly feminist. But there are things that go on in their lives to do with race, but that is determined by how they appear in the world and the social world they move in and the colour of their skin, how dark or light they are, and the part of the country they're living in. So those things also impact on whether racism affects them or not. And racism is a thread in the novel, but it's not necessarily the predominant thread, because, like as you said, there's sexism. There's also wider issues around gender. I have a character who is non-binary. There's also issues around class and all kinds of things bubbling away beneath the surface.
And I think the sense of otherness, the embarrassment at not being able to feel comfortable with one's self, is something that certainly resonated with me as a blind person, that a lot of your characters are more likely to blame themselves for some of the attitudes that they receive from other people than to actually point the finger at the person who has the bad attitude.
Again, this is another interesting observation. You write a book and it's open to interpretation. I think the characters who are probably, perhaps even the characters who are politicised to a certain extent, might perhaps be lacking the confidence that they might have if they weren't women of colour. And then there are the characters who are not at all politicised, and they're not necessarily going to understand how society works and how the structures of racism and sexism work in society. And perhaps they do look at their own failings rather than point the finger outwards, because they haven't got the kind of political education that will help people understand the structures operating in our society. That is an interesting observation, and nobody said that to me, and that's not something I thought myself. But I'm not denying it. I just haven't thought about the characters in these ways. I think of them as women triumphing over obstacles, however they can. So there's Carol, who is a banker. And she comes from a Nigerian immigrant background in what was a poor area of southeast London called Peckham. It's no longer quite so poor because it's been gentrified. And she goes to a very bad, rough school, but she has a teacher who helps her. And she gets into Oxford, and it changes her outlook on life, and she changes herself, and she kind of rejects her background. And she goes into the corporate world, and she very much becomes somebody who's part of the corporate machine and is very successful at it. But there is a cost to that. And that is that she's forgotten her roots. But I think one of the themes in the novel, again, what I didn't say initially, is that I'm very interested in where characters begin their lives and the journey they take to where they end up. So Carol is somebody for whom you would never have predicted that she would have become this corporate beast in this corporate machine. But that is what she becomes very, very successfully. Then you've got Amma, who's a theatre director, who's been on the fringes for like 40 years directing plays that the so-called mainstream hasn't been interested in. And now she's got a show opening at the National Theatre in London. And this is a huge breakthrough for her. And it's a play that she's written herself, and she feels that she hasn't compromised to be in the heart of the establishment. And then you've got a character like Hattie, who is the oldest character at 93, who is from Northumberland, has lived there all her life, is a farming woman. And in a sense, her trajectory has been one of the most stable, in a sense, because she's lived a very long life. The farm that she lives on is her family farm that's been in her family for 200 years. She was born there. She's never left there. She's a farmer. She's a farming woman. She's a woman of Black heritage. And she's going to die on the farm. She's not going to let anybody put her into a home. But what happened to her life was that an African-American came to her village and started to politicize her and change her outlook. But somebody like Hattie, a 93-year-old woman of Black heritage living in the back of beyond in the deepest rural Northumberland, has no relationship to the metropolitan younger Black women. The language they speak is a very different language. But she has a great-granddaughter who is non-binary. So that's where the very modern world starts to encroach upon her world, not that she's particularly receptive to it.
There are recurring motifs through the book and recurring themes. Education is seen as a way of rising out of the socioeconomic position that you were born into. Role models are deeply important. Shirley is a teacher, and whilst she might not be a role model who people look up to, she certainly is able to point her pupils towards more successful role models than becoming a baby mother or whatever. Those are clearly things that you feel very strongly about, and actually you work in education yourself, don't you?
I do, don't I? Yeah, I feel passionately about education, but I also feel passionately about people learning how to be successful in this society. Mm. So education is one way in, but you also have to be socialized to know how to move in the circles where the power lies. So I'm very interested in who has power and who doesn't. My background's in theatre, so initially I used to teach drama, and then I've been teaching creative writing since the early 90s, but I've only had a permanent position in the university, at Brunel University, London, where I'm Professor of Creative Writing, since 2011. And so I have spent now 8 years encountering undergraduates, as well as students studying masters and PhDs, but predominantly undergraduates. And the university that I work in is a very diverse university, and I'm really interested to see how the students make their way through a system that is not necessarily a system they've been trained to understand, especially students who are the children of migrants from other countries, mm-hmm. or students of colour, and any student who is the first person in their family to go to university, which is the case at Brunel University London. So I'm very interested in that. And I do believe that education is one of the ways in which we can rise above our socioeconomic status. And I do believe that you need to be a role model, and that our sense of community comes from understanding that even though we're individuals, and myself as a writer, I'm very individualistic, of course, that's what being a writer is in part. But I also feel a strong sense of community, and that I cannot just pursue my own career. I need to look around and see the ways in which I can help other people pursue their goals and understand how the system works in this country. And anybody from a marginalized community is not necessarily going to have insight into how this country works, especially, as I said, if your family are immigrants. They don't have an inside view on British society. I'm lucky because my father was Nigerian, my mother is English. So I grew up in a household where my mother was English. And that's, I think, a very different experience to growing up with two parents who are immigrants. So I always had a way of seeing Britain from the inside as a mixed race person. And I'm a literary activist, so I've set up these various initiatives to support other people in the arts and other writers and so on, of colour in particular, who I think have been overlooked. So that is sewn into the book is, I think, just me working out these issues on a subconscious level.
There's a particularly joyous scene in the book set in a high-rise block in King's Cross where everybody's differences actually prevent any progress being made on how to sort out the problems of the block, which is a lovely reminder that if we bring our identity politics to the table, we actually have to listen to other people's identity politics.
That's true. I came of age in the 80s and I was very much involved in alternative arts and the theatre world and part of a community of young Black women and not so much men, but young Black women trying to find our voices in this society. And I used to go to black women's conferences in the early 80s, and the whole conference could be spent arguing about who was black and who wasn't and who was allowed to be there and who wasn't. And that would extend to whether Asian women were allowed to be black, whether mixed race women were allowed to be black, whether Turkish women were allowed to identify as black. So for me, it was a joyous thing to write that section, actually, because it was so much something that I remember from my past, when everybody was just fighting each other. But really, you were all on a sort of counter-cultural battlefront, trying to be heard and trying to change society, hopefully in positive ways. Mm. And society, with a capital S, wasn't really interested in you. But you're fighting each other instead. And we know that that's something that's very endemic to politics, for example. I mean, we're witnessing it right now
in
British politics. So it's interesting that you noted that. I had a lot of fun writing that passage, I have to say.
Also feel that London's a very important character in the book as well. It's a place where you can be an individual and not necessarily always be judged for your appearance.
Yes, I think that's true. It's not just a London book, and I really didn't want it to just be a London book, but London is such rich material for fiction because its history is so deep and well recorded, and it's so heterogeneous in so many different ways, that it's very hard not to be drawn to the city. But it is true. London is full of lots of different Londons. Geographically, it's full of lots of different Londons because we have all our villages. We have our Hampstead village and our Blackheath village, and we have the town of Woolwich, where I grew up, and we have the village of Eltham, and we have the village of Notting Hill, and we have the village of Streatham and Peckham, and they're all still quite distinct areas. And so my characters come from different areas, although quite a few of them come from southeast London. I agree with you that London is somewhere where you can be who you are. That doesn't mean to say that we're living in some kind of utopian state in this city. Far from it. And a lot of what looks like equality of opportunity and mixing across the divides can be quite superficial, I think, when you scratch beneath the surface, and that people are quite tribal and they do tend to stick in their own little groups. It is an incredible, dynamic city. But at the same time, I also wanted to look at other parts of the country.
And I think that tension between the opportunities that London affords and also the cracks between the paving slabs that you can easily fall into is shown very clearly at the school that two of your characters teach in. Whilst the new generation may be more colourblind than previous generations, it's also more polarised.
That's right. So you have somebody like Shirley, her parents were the Windrush generation. She's done well. They were working on the buses. She's a school teacher. She's leading a very middle-class life, although she doesn't really appreciate it. But she has quite an easy life compared to her parents. Her mother would stand on the platform of a bus for like however many hours her shift was every day and earn very little money. But then at the school has changed over the years and become rougher. We do experience the underclass, and there's one character in the novel, Letitia, who is what you call a baby mother in the sense that she's had lots of children with different men and is somebody who definitely appears to be slipping through the cracks. So I felt that I needed to have a character who, even though she's starting to rise above it, I needed to have a character who perhaps most closely resembled the kinds of young women who are low achievers in this society and end up on welfare benefits and don't know how to rise above that. She was a friend, a childhood friend of Carol, who becomes a banker. So they're two girls, same school, but they have completely different paths in life. And I think I'm always interested in characters who slip through the cracks, as well as characters who rise above that, because I don't want to create victims, especially with my female characters. So the school that Shirley's at changes over the years, and it does become a school where there are gangs and there's violence and so on and so forth. And we know that's so true of schools, not only in London, but also in other parts of the country, and children killing each other. And she's somebody who eventually hates her job until she becomes somebody who becomes a mentor to some of the brighter children. And that becomes her saving grace in a way.
I think that focus on the positives that can still be drawn from the school, from a life of really hard graft before you finally get your success with a play, makes it, as you say, far more of a celebratory book than looking at the social problems in Britain from under a microscope.
My characters might be sometimes victims of circumstance, but I can't turn them into victims. Mm. And I feel that it's my duty as a writer to offer hope for people's lives, I don't really like fiction. Well, that's not true, actually. I really liked The Road by Cormac McCarthy, and that is one of the bleakest books you can ever read. But certainly for my work, I don't want my work to be bleak. I don't want to indulge in any of those porny ways in which fiction might be written so that people feel browbeaten when they're reading it and the focus is on tragedy and trauma and suffering. And I think, as particularly as a black writer, there has been a bit of a tendency for the literary world to love those stories that are, in quotes, heartbreaking. That in a way, black writing has to be heartbreaking, and especially African writing and child soldiers, civil war, brutality, trauma. And I'm not saying there isn't a place for that in fiction, and I don't deny that in my work, because people do go through difficult times and so on, but I don't want to play into that expectation that our lives are about suffering, because I find that really paternalistic and patronising. Mm.
It's almost as if the audience has to suffer alongside the characters so that we can feel your pain.
And nothing happens and nothing changes.
Yes. So you must be delighted that a major literary prize like the Booker Prize has selected your book for the shortlist and that it stands a pretty good chance of winning.
Well, you don't know, do you? The Booker Prize, it's the golden cup, isn't it, in this country, and its reputation is global. And I have been following it since the 1980s, off and on. Sometimes I've completely disinvested in it because I've been fed up with the books that have won. But generally, it's always on my radar. And I really didn't think I would be somebody who would be up for it. And maybe everybody thinks that until they are, because it just felt like my work was too radical for such an establishment prize. But it's changed in recent years with some of the people who've won it. And I think it's become... Well, I think it's probably always been open to experiment, but certainly some of the more recent writers have been possibly quite experimental. Mm. And I think society has changed in terms of black women's creativity. Not that we're there yet, not that we're treated equally, but I do think that there's more receptiveness to us. There's more receptiveness to feminist ideology. There's a little bit more discussion of race in this country. Sexuality and gender have been big issues to be discussed, have been discussed for a few years now. And when I wrote this book, it really did fight a writing into a void. And I was just so annoyed that there were so few black British women getting published. But by the time this book came out, the scene felt a little healthier. And what being on the shortlist does for me is draw attention to my work to a much wider audience. And that's what I want for my work. I don't want to write for a very small market. And this shortlisting has the potential to open up my voice, and as I say, my 12 primarily black British women's voices, to this country and to more of the world. And I think that's really important, because we're just not heard out there in the world beyond less than a handful of famous names. So I'm absolutely thrilled. You can't predict who's going to win, but it's at this stage, I'm just so happy to be here.
Thanks to the Booker Foundation's commitment to making books accessible to those of us who are print disabled, you're reaching a blind and partially sighted audience with your wonderful audiobook. I don't know whether you've actually heard the narration.
Yes.
She just captures the voices of all the characters beautifully individually.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. I'm glad you say so. Yes. Because we don't get much feedback on audiobook. You get reviews and so on of the written book, but not much on audiobook. So I'm glad to hear that you like it. Yeah.
And have you read any of the other books on the Booker shortlist yet?
I've read Elif Shafak's, which I think is a really, really strong book. She's writing about outsiders in Turkey, and she does it through multiple voices again. And it's very descriptive, very evocative, very moving. That's the only one so far.
Well, I wish you the very best of luck over the next month, and I hope you enjoy the wider recognition that comes with being shortlisted. And just remains for me to say, Bernardine Evaristo, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much for having me on the programme.
Amma then spent decades on the fringe, a renegade lobbing hand grenades at the establishment that excluded her, until the mainstream began to absorb what was once radical, and she found herself hopeful of joining it. Which only happened when the first female artistic director assumed the helm of the National 3 years ago. After so long hearing a polite no from her predecessors, She received a phone call just after breakfast one Monday morning when her life stretched emptily ahead, with only online television dramas to look forward to. Love the script, must do it. Will you also direct it for us? I know it's short notice, but are you free for a coffee this week at all? Emma takes a sip of her Americano, with its customary Kickstarter extra shot in it, as she approaches the brutalist grey arts complex ahead. At least they try to enliven the bunker-like concrete with neon light displays these days, and the venue has a reputation for being progressive rather than traditionalist. Years ago, she expected to be evicted as soon as she dared walk through its doors, a time when people really did wear their smartest clothes to go to the theatre and look down their noses at those not in proper attire. She wants people to bring their curiosity to her plays, doesn't give a damn what they wear, as her own sod-used style anyway, which has evolved, it's true, away from the cliché denim dungarees, Che Guevara beret, PLO scarf and ever-present badge of two interlocked female symbols. Talk about wearing your heart on your sleeve, girl.
For more information on Girl, Woman, Other and all the books shortlisted for the Booker Prize, past and present, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. And Bernadine will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, a 1,000-page book written in just 8 sentences, but first... What do the judges look for when putting a novel forward for the shortlist for the Booker Prize? The internationally renowned pianist Joanna McGregor is one of this year's panel, and, as I found out when I met her at the announcement party, musicality played a key part in her judgment. I just bumped into Joanna McGregor, who's one of this year's judges. Joanna, it's quite something to take on being a judge for the Booker Prize, isn't it?
Yes, it really is, and nothing really prepares you for the tsunami of books that are going to arrive daily. They do say, you know, it's a lot of work, there's going to be a lot of books, and you go, yeah, that's fine. And it is an amazing experience, because you basically read a book a day to begin with, to get through the full 151 books that we had to read. And then as things begin to get through to the next round, things slow down and you have the luxury of a whole week, say, to read a book, you know.
Do you enjoy coming back to a book a second time and reading it?
Oh, it's very interesting, this process, because normally you come back to a book after a period of years, don't you? You love a book and then you say... So I remember absolutely adoring Stendhal's The Red and the Black when I was a teenager, and then many years later I revisited it because I remembered how great it was. And of course this process means you're revisiting the book like a month later or something, because you need to go and have a second look at a book before it makes it onto the long list, let alone the short list. So we've now read these books 3 times in a very short space of time, and it's a very interesting process because for the books it's really under scrutiny, you know. I mean, it's quite a harsh thing for a book, so of course if a book keeps coming, it just shows how strong it is.
Do you read them solely in print, or have you been tempted to listen to them in audiobook if they've been available?
I haven't listened at all to audiobooks, which I think is probably a really good idea. So I read in 2 formats. One was the prints. We were either getting hardbacks or softbacks, or manuscripts in the case of Margaret Atwood, or PDFs. And because I was doing a lot of travelling during this period, you know, I went to New Zealand to play some concerts. I went to Australia. I went to China. I was all over the place. So, of course, having some of them on... all of them came on a PDF as well. Having them on my laptop was great. And actually, that's quite a test of a book as well, because you're not looking at a tight print. You're not looking at a cover. You're not looking at beautiful paper, beautifully laid out. You know, you're just looking at the words. So that's quite a different experience from holding the book in your hands.
I know that last year's winner, Anna Burns's Milkman, it was a tough physical read for not being paragraphed in such a standard way. And obviously one of this year's shortlisted books, Lucy Ellman's book, is likewise. Did you find that challenging, or once you got into it, did you find it opened the book up to you?
You know, I'm a musician and I spend my life looking at scores, And reading a musical score is like looking at a graphic and interpreting the graphic, because all music, even if it's just standard classical music, even if it's Beethoven, it's full of codes and signs and signals and confusions that you have to interpret. And then, of course, when you hit the 20th century or the 21st century, it becomes even more astonishing, like a John Cage graphic score. And the minute I saw Lucy Ellman's work, her book, I thought immediately of great 20th century composers, and I immediately saw it as a fantastic musical score, and I didn't have any trouble with it at all. I thought it was sensational straight away. And actually, there's another book that's very interestingly laid out, Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other. Similarly, it's a verse form novel, so it's got gaps, you know, unlike Lucy's. Lucy's book is pretty dense, but it's equally visually arresting and interesting, and somehow emotionally immediately conveys the power and the urgency of what they're trying to tell you. And I suppose as a musician, I'm very used to that. You know, I'm very used to looking at a score which might come in different shapes and sizes and might need to tell me something quite urgent about. It's not necessarily easy to look at, but that doesn't matter.
The winner of this year's Philip Carnegie novel was another verse novel, and likewise, I actually felt rather lucky being a blind person and being able to listen to it, because I think it made sense immediately to me as a reader, rather than, I don't know, looking to see if the last two letters of each sentence rhymed. I suppose originally all storytelling was oral, so maybe we are just going back to the source.
I think you're absolutely right. I've just done a big project with Alice Oswald, who of course is one of the great sort of oral storytellers of our time, you know, a poet who does tremendous performances, and I just literally a couple of weeks ago was on stage with her. I was providing a sort of musical improvised accompaniment to her 60 minutes, you know, because she's like Homer, she'll just stand up and do her latest new poem, which is very complex and amazing. And I think you're right. I think we're living in an age where we really, because also it's not just about sound either, it's about the timbre of the voice, it's about a lot of signals that they're giving you in those words, and in some ways it's like a multimedia experience very often. And some audiobooks or some performers might want to have music in the background. One of our long listed novels, Lanny, I know that writer goes around and he gives quite a music and actually a version of his, because that's another verse novel. I mean, that's another novel with a lot of very interesting poetry and graphics in.
It is interesting to hear that there are more audiobooks with musical inserts. I know it causes some people to be a little bit cautious, but I do wonder whether in 5 years' time we will be celebrating the first shortlisted multimedia Booker Prize nominee.
I'm sure that's incredibly, you know, it's absolutely coming. Funnily enough, they asked me to put, because I'm a musician on the panel, they asked me to put a playlist together for these shortlisted books, just what I thought might, you know, work. Not at all to listen to as you read, not at all. It's more like, I was thinking, oh, well, there's Elif Shafak, there's a fantastic Turkish composer called Fazıl Say. A lot of his music is very like her lyricism and her darkness. For Lucy Ellman's work, I thought immediately of Charles Ives and John Cage, and, you know, the beauty and the chaos and the wonderful sort of everything that goes on in that music. And, you know, and you know, I just sort of straight away went, oh, well, musically, it makes me think of this.
Finally, is there a rainy day book that you take with you when you want to curl up and have a day on the city and not talk to your piano?
What a lovely question that is. I think probably in my life I have lots and lots of rainy day novels, and the one I'm hankering after at the moment is a bit of Thomas Hardy, just at the moment, because, and I'm not going to be able to read him until we get to the end of this Booker Prize process in October. And I first encountered Hardy, he meant a lot to me in my teens. I read all of Hardy's novels, like I did Dickens. And there's something very melancholic and all-enveloping about Hardy, whether it's Jude the Obscure or Tess of Devers, doesn't matter, or Far from the Madding Crowd, whatever. And then when I was an older reader, I discovered his poetry, of course, you know. So that would be my curling up in front of the fireside, maybe late autumn when all this madness is over. I'll be able to open my old schoolgirl copy of Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
Well, it's lovely to meet a fellow book lover, and I shall let you get back to the party. Thank you so much for being guest on Read On.
Lovely to talk to you. Thank you.
thanks to Joanna McGregor. And we'll hear more about Lucy Ellman's novel, Ducks Newburyport, in just a few minutes.
I'm Tibor Fisher, and this is my story, Listed for Trial.
This is Julian Barnes, and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson, and I write a series of books featuring DCI Alan Banks.
This is Doris Lessing, and I'm reading a chapter from my novel, The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Here is the news, by Richard Baker, read by the author.
I'm Bill Bryson, reading from my book, One Summer, America, 1927.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Every year, one of the novels shortlisted for the Booker Prize proves particularly controversial with the critics. And this year it was Ducks Newburyport, written by Lucy Ellman. Stylistically, it has a lot in common with James Joyce's Ulysses. Both are meandering streams of consciousness about characters struggling to make sense of the world they inhabit. I met Lucy at the Booker shortlist party before the audiobook version of Ducks Newburyport went into production, so I was keen to learn more. Lucy Ellman, congratulations.
Thank you.
Has it sunk in yet that you've been shortlisted for the Booker Prize?
I don't know. It's all very new to me. It never occurred to me that this would happen, and I'm sort of watching to see what it is. I don't really know what it is yet.
You're no stranger to publishing. I believe this is your eighth book?
It's my eighth book, my seventh novel. Some people have included another thing I wrote, which was actually almost a children's book. It's a children's book for adults about a cat, and I illustrated it. So it's not exactly what I consider a novel.
The book is going to be made into an audiobook, a talking book, so that blind and partially sighted readers can enjoy it as well. Did you read it back to yourself while you were writing it?
I actually tend to hear words in my head when I'm reading anything. And when I'm writing, I hear them. I don't usually say it out loud, but I read it again and again, and yes, I'm hearing the voice. And for the audio, I'm hoping to get a friend of mine who's a wonderful actress to do the reading, because I think she'll get it, and she's funny.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I sometimes listen to Jane Austen audio stuff when I'm cooking or something, but it's often very irritating because I don't think they're doing it right. Now, that's a danger. It's really hard to get it right for everybody.
Now, when I read the synopsis and the review of your book, it immediately made me think of Ulysses by James Joyce, or maybe Finnegan's Wake. And I believe your father is actually a Joyce scholar. Do you think Joyce is in your DNA?
All my life, people ask me questions about Joyce as if I must be born knowing everything. And it's been quite embarrassing, because I don't know much. I've read my father's biography and read Ulysses. And I haven't even read Finnegan's Wake yet. But I'm planning to now. I think I'm old enough now. Literature is in my blood. We just grew up talking about literature and thinking about literature and listening to my mother complain that my father wouldn't shut up about Joyce and that kind of thing. I didn't base it consciously in any way on Ulysses. It did become quite long. It is a sort of stream of consciousness. And I intentionally didn't reread Molly Bloom's soliloquy, just
to see if that was like what I was doing. I just hoped for the best and that I wasn't doing the same thing. And a lot of people mention my father and not my mother, and I actually think my mother was an enormous influence on my whole thinking, and she was an incredibly witty feminist writer. That's another huge influence. But a lot of people want to talk about Ulysses and the fact that my book isn't Ulysses, and I don't know what to say. I'm sorry, it isn't.
It does strike me as a book that is a reaction to the constant stream of information that we're all getting and the need to be able to process it and list it. I think Umberto Eco said that you need lists to keep yourself sane in this modern world.
Yes, I started out thinking lists were sort of a hideous male invention, particularly beloved of the Nazis, and I came to find them much more and more interesting as a way of juxtaposing all kinds of different stuff. But the other thing, I've always been interested in how you're beaten around the head all day long by these ideas you don't need, and they corrupt you and they interrupt what you're thinking about, and there's more and more of that. So I think the main character in this is subject to all that. She's suffering from it. She's not really aware of it either. She's just living this life, this a barrage of information and interruption. And nobody thinks anymore because they don't have time.
Well, it's funny walking around this party and just bumping into so many hands held low and holding mobile phones and realizing that people are looking down and not really talking to each other.
You've been checking out where their hands are.
Only because people get very defensive when you walk into their mobile phones as a blind person.
Oh, God. I don't have a phone like that either. But it's amazing. People just don't want any real experience of the world anymore. They're constantly looking at this machine.
I always like to finish by asking my guest to tell me about a book that made them fall in love with reading or wish to become a writer. Was there a specific book that made you do that?
There was a book I really admired as a child that my sister was given, and she wouldn't let me read it for a while, and she really liked it. I was very jealous of this book, and I finally got it, and I really thought it was a very good book. I was astounded, and I remember being very interested in the fact that there were three different voices. Two are in the same generation, I think one is in the next generation, and I was very impressed by that. And it's called A Candle in Her Room by Ruth M. Arthur, and I never see it around, and nobody seems to know about it. And I thought it was a great book.
Lucy Ellman, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Ducks Newburyport is currently being recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios by narrator Stephanie Allain, with Braille, giant print and synthetic voice versions already available from the RNIB library. Thanks to the Booker Foundation's commitment to making all the books on the shortlist accessible to those with visual impairments. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Bernardine Evaristo for the books of her life. Bernardine, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
I don't remember any book making me want to become an author because I wasn't thinking about that at the time, but I wanted to be an actor and that was my first career. But the book that made perhaps the biggest impression on me is actually a radio play, Under Milkwood, by Dylan Thomas. And we did a production of it at school, which is how I was introduced to it. And I absolutely loved it. I loved the orality of it. I loved the characters, these kind of quirky characters. I loved the humor. I loved how he was able to convey this tiny little Welsh fishing village in a few words. And it was definitely later, I can see, the seminal influence on the kind of writing style that I would eventually develop.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the web-foot cockle women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseau, bridesmaided by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night and the jolly rogered sea, and the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the roofs. You can hear the dew falling, and the hushed town breathing. Only your eyes are unclosed to see the black and folded town fast and slow asleep. And you alone can hear the invisible starfall, the darkest before dawn minutely dew-gray stir of the black, dab-filled sea, where the Arethusa, the Curlew, and the Skylark, Zanzibar, Rhiannon, the Rover, the Cormorant, and the Star of Wales tilt and ride. Listen. It is night moving in the streets, the processional salt slow musical wind in Coronation Street and Cockle Row. It is the grass growing on Llareggub Hill, dewfall, starfall, the sleep of birds in Milkwood. Look, it is night dumbly, royally winding through the coronation cherry trees, going through the graveyard of Bethesda with winds gloved and folded and dew-doffed, tumbling by the sailor's arms. Time passes. Listen. Time passes. Come closer now. Only you can hear the houses sleeping in the streets in the slow, deep, salt and silent black bandaged night. Only you can see in the blinded bedrooms the combs and petticoats over the chairs, the jugs and basins, the glasses of teeth thou shalt not on the wall, and the yellowing dicky bird watching pictures of the dead. Only you can hear and see behind the eyes of the sleepers the movements and countries and mazes and colors and dismays and rainbows and tunes and wishes and flight and fall and despairs and big seas of their dreams. From where you are, you can hear their dreams.
Under Milkwood by Dylan Thomas is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB20490, which is narrated by Richard Burton and Sean Phillips. Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
So many books. I think I'm going to go for Ben Okri, The Famished Road. He won the Booker, of course. I think it was in 1991. Nigerian writer. And I don't remember much about the novel, to be honest. I read it once, but I absolutely loved it. And I remember the sensation of reading something that to me was so extraordinarily brilliant. I couldn't put it down. I was in awe of his prose style, of his imagination, of his ability to convey this Nigerian spirit world that he writes about. And I'd like to revisit it and see what I think today.
In the beginning, there was a river. The river became a road, and the road branched out to the whole world. And because the road was once a river, it was always hungry. In that land of beginnings, spirits mingled with the unborn, We could assume numerous forms. Many of us were birds. We knew no boundaries. There was much feasting, playing, and sorrowing. We feasted much because of the beautiful terrors of eternity. We played much because we were free. And we sorrowed much because there were always those amongst us who had just returned from the world of the living. They had returned inconsolable for all the love they had left behind, all the suffering they hadn't redeemed, all that they hadn't understood, and for all that they had barely begun to learn before they were drawn back to the land of origins. There was not one amongst us who looked forward to being born. We disliked the rigors of existence, the unfulfilled longings, the enshrined injustices of the world, the labyrinths of love, the ignorance of parents, the fact of dying, and the amazing indifference of the living in the midst of the simple beauties of the universe. We feared the heartlessness of human beings, all of whom are born blind, few of whom ever learn to see. Our king was a wonderful personage who sometimes appeared in the form of a great cat. He had a red beard and eyes of greenish sapphire. He had been born uncountable times and was a legend in all worlds, known by 100 different names. It never mattered into what circumstances he was born. He always lived the most extraordinary of lives. One could pore over the great invisible books of lifetimes and recognize his genius through the recorded and unrecorded ages. Sometimes a man, sometimes a woman, he wrote incomparable achievements from every life. If there is anything common to all of his lives, the essence of his genius, it might well be the love of transformation and the transformation of love into higher realities. With our spirit companions, the ones with whom we had a special affinity, we were happy most of the time because we floated on the aquamarine air of love. We played with the fauns, the fairies, and the beautiful beings, tender sibyls, benign sprites, and the serene presences of our ancestors were always with us, bathing us in the radiance of their diverse rainbows. There are many reasons why babies cry when they are born, and one of them is the sudden separation from the world of pure dreams, where all things are made of enchantment, and where there is no suffering.
The Famished Road by Ben Okri is available in a full range of accessible formats from the library, including as TB9219, narrated by Ben Onukwe. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I read Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss recently, and it's a very short book, but my God, it packs a punch. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't want to give anything away, but it's about a girl whose father is a sort of Iron Age enthusiast, and he takes his daughter and his wife to a remote part of the country to kind of reenact an Iron Age way of living. And through this, we get a sense of how people lived during the Iron Age. But there's so much going on with that book, and it's thrilling and it's shocking. It brings the Iron Age alive in some ways, but it's also about a guy who wants to feel a sense of belonging to a Britain before immigration. But, of course, that's not true because Britain has always been settled by immigrants. So that's also something in the book. But it's also about her relationship with her father and her mother and some other people who get involved in this Iron Age reenactment. And I think it's a really magical book.
They bring her out. Not blindfolded, but eyes widened to the last sky, the last light. The last cold bites her fingers and her face. The stones bruise her bare feet. There will be more stones before the end. She stumbles. They hold her up. No need to be rough. Everyone knows what is coming. From deep inside her body, from the cord in her spine and the wide bloodways under the ribs, from the emptiness of her womb and the rising of her chest, she shakes. a body in fear. They lead the fearful body over the turf and along the track, her bare feet numb to most of the pain of rock and sharp rushes. Chanting rises. The drums sound slow, unsyncopated with the last panic of her heart. Others follow, wrapped against the cold, dark figures processing into the dusk. On arrival, they strip her. It is easy. They've put her into a loose tunic. Against the low red light of the winter sunset, her body is white as chalk, solid against the wisps of fog and the tracery of reed. She tries to cover herself with her hands and is not allowed. One holds her while the other binds her. Her breathing is accelerated, its condensation settling on her face. Exhaled breaths hang like spirits above each person's head, slowly dissolving into the air. The men turn her to face the crowd. They display her to her neighbours and her family, to the people who held her hands as she learnt to walk, taught her to dip her bread in the pot and wipe her lips, to weave a basket and gut a fish. She's played with the children who now peep at her from behind their mothers, has murmured prayers for them as they were being born. She has been one of them, ordinary.
Ghost Wall by Sarah Moss is available commercially in print, ebook, and audio, which is narrated by Christine Hewitt. Bernadine Evaristo, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.